Welcome, everyone, to KRFY Morning Show's Garden Life, a monthly feature about gardening as the antidote for our world today, a way to honor and embrace our Mother Earth, nourish and restore our families, and a tonic for our community. This is Julie Prochinski, and I'm here today with Julie Calamine. Hi, Julie.
Hey, Julie Prochinski. Thanks for inviting me.
We have an awesome expert with us today. From the Bonner County Extension Office, it's Jennifer Jensen, who is an educator with the Horticulture and Small Acre Farms. Welcome, Jennifer.
Welcome. Thank you for having me.
Please introduce yourself to our listeners, if you would.
As you mentioned, I'm Jennifer Jensen, and I work as the Extension Educator in the University of Idaho Extension Office here in Bonner County. And we provide educational programs that focus on horticulture and small farm production. My background is in plant science, and I love gardening. I have had the opportunity to work in different gardens and enjoy working in my own garden as well.
That's a great reason to have you here, because that's what we're all about. Jennifer, have you been with the Extension Agency for a while?
I have now. I have been here at the Bonner County office for about 7 years. And prior to that, I worked in the Boundary County office for about 5 years.
And as I recall, in previous invitations, we've had both you and your companion from Boundary County, Kate Painter, but I understand Kate's now retired.
She is, yes, and we miss having her, but the university will be replacing that position eventually. They are working on it, but has not been replaced just yet.
Yeah, and before we jump into really some wonderful questions that Julie Prochinski has put together for us today, if you would give us a little bit of an overview about what is the Extension, what does U of I Extension do? You're actually college professors, aren't you?
Well, technically we are professors within the College of Agriculture through the University of Idaho, but our jobs are really to connect the general public with the research that has been done through different universities. So we provide programs here in the county for both youth and adults that is research-based information. And like I say, we focus our programs here mostly on horticulture and small farms, but we have other educators that focus on forestry programs and others on food preservation and food safety programs, as well as we offer the 4-H youth development program.
Wow, you are busy.
Yes.
Well, today our show is titled A Happy Garden. We're beginning with preventing problems. So a happy garden is a healthy garden. Is everywhere I look for information, and even looking out in my own garden, is a healthy garden is a happy garden. So beginning with how to keep a garden happy, let's talk about where we should start with preventing problems. These are called cultural controls. So I'll start with soil tests. That seems like the place to begin.
Yes. So soil, understanding your soil is a very important part of growing a successful garden. And you can find out a lot of good information from a soil test. I will say that there is a whole ecosystem within the soil that some of the standard soil tests don't look at exactly. So it's just important to remember to encourage all of those beneficial microorganisms in the soil, in addition to making sure that the soil has good texture. So good amounts of sand, silt, and clay for good drainage. And then also the chemical properties of the soil, which is what you generally see in a soil test, like your pH and the different nutrients that are available.
Yeah, so to just make sure I'm understanding you correctly, the soil test is the first step. Maybe you find out what your pH levels are and what your minerals and all those things are, but there are more levels, the textures of your soil, what's living in it, all those things.
Yes. Sometimes just digging in your soil can give you a good idea of that structure or tilt of the soil. But then that whole ecosystem of the soil can be affected by things such as the pH and the other minerals in the soil as well. And most soil tests will also look at the percent organic matter that's in the soil, and that's part of a food source for those beneficial microorganisms. So knowing that and trying to increase that organic matter in your soil can be beneficial.
So with the soil test, do you get advice?
It depends on which laboratory you use. So the University of Idaho does have a lab that tests soil and gives you some available nutrients levels, as well as pH and organic matter. When you go through the University of Idaho, they don't give recommendations, but they do say call your extension office. So you can call and talk to myself, and we are always happy to help interpret those results. Other private labs do generally offer some recommendations, whether the readings are low or high, and what types of soils might be recommended. And that's basically, I can help with those tests as well to help determine what sort of levels you have in your gardens and what fertilizers might be best.
Sure, and that would depend a little bit on what you're planning on growing, too.
Exactly, yes. It does differ based on what plants you're growing.
Those little store-bought ones, do you think they're effective? The ones you put the dirt and the water and wait for a color?
You know, I haven't seen any research that specifically says. I think in general they might be able to give you a decent idea of what's there. Going through an analytical laboratory is probably going to be a bit more exact, however. But remember, a soil test isn't something that maybe you need to do every year, but maybe every 3 to 5 years in your garden to help make sure that you're staying on track.
It definitely when you begin, so you know what you're working with.
Right. Understanding right. Those base levels is good.
So nutrients, let's just talk just a real quick minute about nutrients. What is lime? Well, how does lime work?
So lime is actually generally added to the soil to increase the pH. So if you have acidic soil, the pH measures the amount of hydrogen ions in the soil. And if your soil is acidic, you can add lime to it to make it more alkaline.
Base, that's another term,
correct.
Right? Base or alkaline.
Oh, okay.
Neutralize the acid.
Right. And if you had basic or alkaline soil, the reverse element you would add would be the sulfur, which will then lower the pH of your soil.
And okay. Make it more acid, right?
Correct.
I know. And what is neutral? It's
neutral is 7, and anything below 7 is acidic in the pH scale, and anything above 7 is alkaline.
Are our soils here one or the other usually?
Most of the soils that I've seen have been slightly acidic, so somewhere between 6 and 7 on that pH scale. But there are some that are alkaline and some that are even more acidic, so down around 4 or 4.5.
Whoa, that is acidic.
And you know, some of those plants do like the acidic soils, like the blueberries. They can handle it 4.5, 5.5. So, but most of our garden crops that we're growing like it slightly acidic, between 6 and 7.
Okay. So we're starting out in pretty good shape, generally.
Yes.
Good.
How about Epsom salts? That's one more thing I have a question about that I see many places about adding it to your soil. It's out at the co-op.
So Epsom salts are magnesium sulfate. And so if those nutrients are low in your soil, then you would want to add them to your soil. They aren't always something that is deficient, however. So performing a soil test first, like you say, to know what you're starting with, to see whether that nutrient is really needed for your garden or not, is beneficial prior to adding it.
Okay, that's great. Great to know. Another part of happy, healthy, and the cultural controls of a garden is diversity, like avoiding monocultures. Can you talk a little bit about native and resistant plants, heirlooms? How do you avoid monocultures when you're working in your garden?
Well, there's a number of ways that you can design your garden to not have a monoculture. So whether you're having intercropping or companion planting, so that you're not just having a big patch of one particular crop. You may have other crops intermingled among them. That can help diversify your garden. Other times you can be very diverse where you may want be growing your vegetables with your ornamental plants as more of an edible landscaping style. And so you don't just have a row of broccoli or a row of peas. It's all interplanted with ornamental plants as well. So that's another way to approach it. Your native plants are more accustomed to growing in our area, and so they generally won't be stressed by the environment that they're growing in. But that doesn't mean that there aren't diseases and pests that could still affect them.
Sure.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
I love the idea of mixing vegetables and herbs into a beautiful landscape because it makes it more interesting. And for me, it makes me more interested in wanting to get out and, you know, get into my garden and do some weeding and that kind of thing. So I really enjoy having things mixed together.
Yeah, and crop rotation is another.
Correct, yes. So with crop rotation, each year you're planting a different crop in that particular area of your garden so that if you have some sort of pest in that area, you're not planting another host plant in that same spot every year. When you're looking at your crop rotation, it's a good idea to rotate out of the family of plants because a number of our pests will affect different species within a plant family. So rotating to a completely different family in that area about every 4 years or so.
And what are some of the plants that we especially want to rotate out? Are there some ones that really shouldn't be repeated?
You know, your Solanaceae family, those are your tomatoes, potatoes, eggplants. It's a good idea to rotate those. Some of your other plants, such as corn, might be heavy feeders. So it might not be so much of a pest issue, but they may use a lot of nitrogen out of the soil. And so rotating that out with another crop that's not going to use quite as much nitrogen out of the soil can be beneficial.
Great. And then the third thing I have for preventing problems is to make a plan for the conditions that you have. What do you suggest for planning and making up a calendar?
Well, first off, I'd say it's always a great idea to keep a garden journal. So in your journal every year, keep track of maybe unusual weather events that happen. If you've had any pests or disease problems in the past, when did they arrive? When did you notice them? Did you have particular cultivars that did better or worse than others? Keeping track of all of that in a garden journal is one of the best ways to then prepare yourself for the next year to know when to expect the pests and what to do about them.
Be ready for it.
Oh, absolutely. Julie, you may have a number of examples for this, but I've got a good one, and it's from the Sagal School Garden. Don Childress and I have been helping the kids out there for either 4 or 5 years now, and doggone it, if every year we don't plant our pole beans and they come up about 4 inches and then they're just attacked by something on the leaves. And we always forget that we need the diatomaceous earth, and then we get it, but then they've got to recover a little bit because they've just been chewed on. Do you have anything
every
like
year.
That?
And oh, yeah.
I should know
yes.
it because it happens every year.
Oh, the slug families that live in my yard are taking over my world.
Right now.
Yes.
Yes.
I have the same problem in my garden as well.
All right. So planning. So that is the cultural part of getting ready for your garden. But when problems arrive, we still have three choices of how to take care of them. We have physical controls, biological controls, and chemical controls. So starting with the physical controls, and I'll begin with slugs. I finally got a little container with a little bit of gas on top and have been dropping my slugs in there in the early morning slug-killing walk.
Oh,
I have. But what other physical controls are there?
Yes, hand picking can be quite useful, especially on a small scale garden. Other things might include a hard water spray to knock off aphids from the plants. A lot of times when you knock them off, they break a leg or something and they can't get back on the plant. And so they are pretty much goners at that point in time. Also pruning, if you've got diseased areas, and just pruning out diseased areas can be beneficial. Even just shaking your plants to get rid of some of the pests.
Yeah. And tomato plants are one that you just really have to keep a track of the lower leaves. If they start to look not right, those have to go, don't they? That's a physical control.
It could be, yes, but picking off those leaves that are looking poorly.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Mm-hmm. And the aphids sometimes hit the end of the branch, so just the to tip off the branch too. I've done that through the years.
Yeah. Yes. Mm-hmm. And sometimes when you pick them off, you can also just drop them in soapy water. For a number of our soft-bodied insects, when they're exposed to a soapy solution, they'll desiccate and die.
Oh, good. Boy. Then you don't smell like gas the whole rest of the day.
There's no good end to these plants. These little bugs that we remove, is there?
No. Oh. It's not a no-kill policy, Julie.
No.
I'd like to mention another physical barrier is tanglefoot. We use that every year with the ants that march up the tree up to milk the aphids. So that works for us.
Yes, that can be a good barrier. You can also use tanglefoot or other sticky products as a sticky trap within your garden to help. It's helpful just for monitoring what is out and about in your garden, but it does also trap them, and so it can contain some of those pest insects.
That's a great idea.
Yeah, and for listeners who haven't heard of this product, I hadn't until I got to know Julie Purchinski. I had no idea what was tanglefoot. Tell us, what is it, Julie?
Oh, it's just a very, very sticky substance that you put on tape around your tree, and you have to make sure it's wrapped perfectly and there's no grooves or anything. That I'm really going for the ants for my tanglefoot on my cherry tree. So you just make sure that they can't cross it, and by the end of the summer it's just full of bodies.
Ant bodies. Those poor ants.
They're so misunderstood.
Oh boy.
Okay, next. I think we've covered physical. I can't think of anything else physical. I really like the water spray. I use that a lot.
I would just say there are some other barriers. The tanglefoot's sort of a barrier for those ants. But for other insects, sometimes a floating row cover over your garden can be beneficial to help prevent those flying pests from getting in and maybe laying eggs on your crop.
Moss, yes. I have a girlfriend who grows all her cabbage undercover.
Yeah, that's true. And then I've seen people use like empty toilet paper rolls for their broccoli when they're little. Is that a useful one? Can that help?
That can be helpful, especially from those cutworms that can come out in the evenings when you're not around, and they just chew your little seedlings right off at the soil line. And so you'll find them flopped over in the morning, detached from their root system.
That's a sad situation. We don't want that.
Speaking of beans, that's what happens to my beans every year is the cutworms. Mm. I used to cut a little straw when I really cared a lot about beans, and put them on each plant, but my time's too valuable now.
Oh, that would be a lot of work, Julie. That would be tough. That would be harder than picking off slugs, I think.
You're listening to KRFY's morning show, Garden Life, with Julie Purchinski and co-host Julie Calamine and our guest Jennifer Jensen, Bonner County's Extension Educator. We'll take a quick musical break now before returning to the rest of the interview. Thanks for listening.
So let the good time roll before we say goodbye. Sometime you're the winning machine, sometime you're the bug. Sometime it all comes together, baby. Sometime you're falling in love. Sometime you're the Louisville slugger, baby. Sometime you're the ball. Sometime it all comes together, baby. Sometime you're gonna lose it all. Sometime you're the winning machine. Sometime you're the bug. Sometime it all comes together, baby. Sometime you're falling in love. Sometime you're the Louisville slugger, baby. Sometime you're the ball.
Biological controls, you know, insects and plants have biological qualities that will help control pests.
That's true, yes. So there are some predatory insects that will feed on other insects that are considered pests, and so they can be beneficial. Your ladybugs are the most common that we think of that will, both the adults and the larvae will of the ladybugs will feed on the aphids. There's other insects, this syrphid fly larva that will feed on the aphids as well. And then there's also predatory mites and beneficial nematodes.
Nematodes, yes, we see those in the catalogs too.
Yes. And there's also other microorganisms that are formulated to act as beneficial sort of biological controls, such as that Bacillus thuringiensis.
Yes. Yes.
And so that's a toxin that's made by a soil bacterium. And when the pest eats it, then it sort of cuts up their insides and kills the pest.
Mm-hmm. I was reading a little bit about compost, and as you compost your garden, the beneficial plants that say you have a companion plant onion that goes with tomatoes, composting those onion heads brings out that beneficial part that helps the tomato. So as you top dress and make compost teas, those beneficials are coming through the compost again. Isn't that something? It's really a good long story about gardening and life. But
yes.
Moving on, let's go to chemicals. Go ahead.
Well,
Jennifer.
Yes. So in some cases, there is a need for a chemical control to be used. And just one thing to note back with the biologicals, sometimes you're not going to get full control from a biological insect as their populations ramp up and they are feeding on the pest insect. That's great. But once the pest is population lowers, then those beneficial populations lower as well. So you don't always get full control with those. And so that might be a case where you want to use some chemical control.
Yeah, and I have a little more to ask about biological as well. On our outline that we are looking at, I see spiders. But another one I think about, because I just heard something about it on another radio program, was about dragonflies. I guess they are massive bug eaters, but I'm not sure if it's garden, you know, if it's for within the garden or if it's more like for eating mosquitoes. Have you ever heard that they can be helpful in the garden?
You know, I'm not sure about that. I'd have to look into it.
Yeah, me either, but I think I will look into it.
Back to biological, since Julie went back there, I was reading toads for slugs and cutworms. So I might get myself a toad.
I like toads. Yeah, I'd like one.
Yeah, that'd be fun to have in your garden to see it hopping around and doing some work for you. Yeah.
Where do we get them, though?
Well, you know, with all of your biological insects or animals, just providing a good habitat for them to survive in, whether it's toads or ladybugs or your pollinator species, attracting them with good habitat, maybe a little bit of water for those animals, maybe a bat house if you're trying to attract bats, making sure that they have what they need to survive in your garden is going to help attract them and then conserve them in your garden.
That's excellent advice. That's where it begins, attracting. Mm-hmm. Okay, back to chemicals. I do have a quick off the top question is, what's the difference between a systemic and an insecticide?
Insecticide is a chemical, a pesticide that will kill insects. Now, there's systemic insecticides and contact insecticides.
Okay.
And contact usually have to be sprayed directly onto the insect or something that they're going to eat to kill them. And then the systemic insecticides move up through the plant and get into the plant tissue that way. And then when the insects feed on them, they consume the pesticide that kills them.
Any insect, though, with the systemic?
Any insect that may be feeding mm-hmm. on that plant.
Mm. Let's talk about oils, too. Oils is something that we can use in our gardens as well.
Right. So there are horticultural oils that are generally like a mineral oil, and they're designed either as a dormant oil, which is usually a thicker viscosity to the oil and is usually just applied to woody plants when they're in the dormant stage. So the leaves have not emerged yet. And then there's summer weight oils that are a lighter weight of oil, and those often can be sprayed once the plants have leafed out for various pests.
Hmm. Julie, I know you're not thrilled when I do this, but I've got to go back to chemical again for systemic versus control, contact controls. Jennifer, do you tend to recommend one, the systemic versus the contact, or do you have a preference if you're given a choice?
Between those two, I don't know that it would really depend on what the pest problem is. For a homeowner that is trying to control something in a large tree that they are mm-hmm. not able to spray the whole tree, there may be a case where the systemic works well. In other cases, a contact might be more appropriate. We are often looking for the least toxic chemical controls, either for us as humans or for the environment. So some of our insecticides will kill a large range of insects, whereas other insecticides are geared towards specific types of insects and will not kill others. So we're usually trying to look for those as well.
Sure. And can you normally understand that by reading your labels? Is that the best way to go about it?
Yes. And I would say with any sort of pesticide you're using, always read and follow the label, because the label is the law. And the site that you're applying that chemical onto the plant needs to be listed on the label for it to be legally applied to that plant or that site. So yes, always follow that. And if the label does not say that it will control the pest that you're trying to control, well, chances are it's not going to be the best choice for that particular pest.
That makes sense. All that information is on there. They're very varied.
Yes. And the labels can be a little bit difficult to read and understand, unfortunately. But I always encourage gardeners to do that. And if you have any questions, you're welcome to call the Extension office and we can try to help with that.
Yeah, that's good to know. And part of the problem is those darn little labels have gotten so small. Is it just me or is that what's happening?
I need to get my reading glasses out for those too.
It's very difficult. Let's take just a moment and understand the process if a person has a question for you. Say they are confused about chemical pesticides or something. What would they do to get in touch with you all?
So they can contact myself through the University of Idaho Extension office and either calling our office. Our number is 263-8511, or just coming into the office or emailing. If it's somebody who's working in a larger scale, perhaps selling at the farmer's market or as a landscaper, I definitely help answer those questions. But we do have our Idaho Master Gardener volunteers that also help home gardeners with questions that they bring in. So folks can come into the office. We have a form that they fill out. We encourage folks to bring a sample of the problem in a plastic bag. And then if they have any photos as well of what's happening, that can be beneficial. And then we have volunteers come in about once a week to help answer those questions.
I saw on your webpage that you even go as far as to tell people how to bring them in, how to prepare them, how to get them in a certain bag. And if there's a rodent problem, don't bring that in.
I thought that was funny.
Yeah.
Don't bring the rodent.
Don't bring it in. Bring a picture.
Yes.
Okay. A couple other things that I used through the years is copper.
So
talk to us.
Yeah, copper can be a good disease control chemical. And so depending, again, it depends on what sort of disease, but you may see it listed as a control for your fruit trees, for instance, or some other diseases. You just want to make sure that it's always a good idea when you are looking at some sort of chemical control to consider all of the options and to try to rotate through the different options so that you're not just using copper year after year after year. There can be some cases where the pest actually becomes resistant to the copper control.
That's interesting.
And what is copper used for? I'm unfamiliar.
So for some of the different diseases, fungal or bacterial diseases in fruit trees in particular.
Yes. Yes. I believe it'll be a big problem for us this year. I've already seen a lot in my cherry trees just from the wet conditions, and mold, mildew seem to be our diseases.
This wet spring has brought on a lot of diseases in fruit trees, also some of our landscape trees and shrubs. Of the plants that have come into our office so far, we've seen different bacterial or fungal cankers on fruit trees, as well as in lilacs and forsythias. So a number of them are really enhanced by this wet weather. They need that wet weather in order to make the infection into the plant. So for a disease to occur, you need the pathogen to be present, you need the host plant to be present, but then you also need the right environmental conditions. And so for many of them, the wet days that we've had has really enhanced those environmental conditions they need.
As the summer dries up, can we hope that some of those fungal issues will just disappear?
Yes, I think some of them will disappear. It will depend on the disease. In some cases, you may be able to prune out the diseased limbs, and there won't be too much spread of that to new infections once we dry out. But that's something to take note in that garden journal and remember for next year, because for some of these diseases, we've seen a number of peach leaf curl diseases come into the office, and there's not too much you can do about it now, but then in the fall and spring, there are some chemical controls you can apply.
Yes. I was reading that you could even dormant oil your trees 4 times a winter.
You could, if it really warrants it, depending on what it is. Oftentimes a fall and late winter, early spring application may be enough, but it can depend on how severely your plant was infected as well.
Or how if they're not resistant. I have a few fruit trees that are not resistant to anything. So it would be a heavy spray for them, but I think it maybe would help in the summer. for the molds and mildews. It seems like airflow is a big part of that too.
Correct. Yes, airflow is important. So going back to those cultural control methods, if you can prune your tree so that it does get good air circulation through it, it's not too dense of a canopy, that can help prevent some of the diseases as well.
Great.
Yeah, that makes sense.
So all of this information we've been talking about, of course, is available in many, many places. The Extension office being the first one you should go to find out information, but seed catalogs and websites and respectable nurseries and the web, it's all out there, and it's such a vast study to learn about all this growing.
It is. I will say that I do encourage folks to seek out university extension websites or other reputable organizations and their websites to help provide more research-based information rather than just any website that may or may not be trying to sell you a certain product.
Sure, sure. And speaking of research, I saw on your website, what's the high tunnel research project?
That's a project that we have completed now, but we were looking at using high tunnel for crop production versus just out in the garden area. And so we worked with a local farmer here and compared the yields that were in the high tunnel, which is generally a larger hoop house type structure. At this particular farm, we also were looking at crops that were grown in smaller hoop houses, just made out of PVC pipe and greenhouse plastic, just tall enough for you to walk under, and then compared to outside environments. And it was an interesting study. It was more of a case study rather than looking at hardcore research. But with the first couple years, the farmer felt that it was sort of a learning curve, understanding how best to grow in the high tunnel. And the yields those first couple years weren't always higher than outside. But then the third year of the study, they were much higher in the high tunnel structure versus outside. And we were looking at crops that preferred the warmer climates, like eggplants and cucumbers.
Tomatoes.
Yeah.
Yeah, you would think, but of course it would depend on the year too. If you had a cool year like this year, if you'd been undercover.
Exactly.
You'd have a big jump start.
Yes.
Okay, Julie? Oh, okay. So, Jennifer, I had asked you to share an antidote with us, and that is just something that you do to go out to feel better about your garden and your life and everything in general.
Well, as I mentioned, I do love to garden, and I often feel like now I just don't have as much time as I would like to spend in my garden, but I was talking to somebody else recently who had some pest problem in their garden, and they had kind of felt embarrassed about it and didn't want to take any photos or talk about it with anyone until after they realized that they had it under control and their control was successful, and they were very proud of it. But I mentioned to her that for me, as an extension educator, I don't really get frustrated when there's so many problems in my gardens. I have so many different weeds, and just this morning I lifted the row cover fabric and found about 8 slugs on one broccoli plant. But I don't let that get to me. I feel like I can always take photos and use them for classes, and it's always a learning experience for me. So I'm always learning something new in my garden, even if it's from a failure or from the successes as well.
That's great.
So by not getting too perfectionistic about your garden, it helps it be the antidote you're looking for. It helps you relax and enjoy it.
It does, yes.
Yeah, that's good.
I take it all in, the whole ecosystem, the good and the bad.
It's very nice. What about you, Julie Prochinski?
Well, I have to say that this week I have been enjoying all of my gardening books, especially when I read Michael Pollan's Botany of Desire. And he talked about the relationship of people with plants. And then Ruth Stout, the no-work gardening. She's such a character. I like to read her. And all the Rodale publications. And it really makes me realize, first of all, like Jennifer said, there's problems. There's going to be problems. This is life. But there's solutions, and sometimes maybe it doesn't matter if there isn't a solution. It's all part of life, and that's the beauty of a garden. It is life.
Right, and not every single crop is a success every year, is it? I mean, we can't assume that that's going to happen with weather and pests and everything. So we just have to be happy about the ones that do work out and feel good about those.
Yes, just try to have a happy garden.
Right. Well, I actually have two anecdotes for this week. And the first one is just the fact that now that school is out and I help with the Sagal school garden, Sagal Elementary Garden, we're just going to have a few of the fourth and fifth graders, soon to be fifth and sixth graders, that will come and join us. And those are the pretty motivated gardeners, the ones who enjoy gardening. And I have to say, I really look forward to that, helping out those youngsters. And we'll be getting going on that next week. They had a week off, and then hopefully we'll be seeing a few of them next week to really get into the details of our raised bed gardens at Sagal. So that's one, definitely an antidote for me. I enjoy it. And then Julie Perchinsky, we didn't even cover this plant on our outline, even though it's on there. And I don't know if you're like me, but I have this massive comfrey plant. Do they just grow until like they're the size of half the state? I don't know. Mine just gets bigger and bigger every year. Well, I was feeling a little discouraged that it was getting so big, and what was I going to do with it? And I went online and looked up uses for comfrey, and I discovered that it makes a nice mulch or compost for both tomatoes and potatoes. So I've got a use for that great big bugger.
Nice. The other thing is soaking it in a pail of water, and it is a fertilizer. You can use it as a fertilizer.
Okay, because I simply placed leaves on my as a sort of a mulch for my tomatoes and potatoes, but I'll try that one too.
Yeah.
Cool.
It is an amazing plant, and it heats up your compost too. If you just put the leaves in your compost. I just keep mine trimmed down. I'll let the bees have the blooms, and then when it starts falling, I'll cut it down, and because you can't get rid of it.
No.
It's like horseradish.
It's persistent, I'll say that.
Yes. You're going to have it. Well, Jennifer, thank you so much for coming with us and this journey with us today through the pests and diseases and how to make your garden a happy garden.
Thank you very much for having me.
It's been our pleasure. Listeners, thank you for joining us here at KRFY Community Conversations. And I think we might be just going back to the straight up morning show now that we're recording everything in here in studio. So maybe we'll just conclude as the KRFY morning show. Thank you, listeners, and we appreciate you.